And co-organizers, thank you very much indeed for inviting me to this lovely spot. I wonder when I come here why I ever gave up physics. It was a big mistake, but anyway, there you are. So. But I'm going to talk about some very practical aspects of malaria evolution. And since most of you aren't malariologists, I'm going to start out with some rather general comments about malaria. My talk's a little bit of a hodgepodge of facts. I'm not going to go deeply into the evolutionary modeling aspects, but I hope that what I say will provide you a framework for the modeling that will come later. I'm also conscious that there are several people in the audience who know more about detailed aspects of what I'm going to talk about than I do myself, so forgive me if I'm sketch over certain things, and I know they'll be fleshed out in later talks. So malaria, as you all know, is a deadly disease. It kills over 500,000 children each year and affects hundreds of millions of people around the world. It's Plasmodium parasites there have a remarkable ability to invade red blood cells. And in this cartoon, it's showing a parasite that's attaching to the surface of the red cell, orientating, and then sort of finding its way into the red cell, invading, and then setting up its own cellular machinery that it's going to use then to replicate and develop within the red cell before it bursts out to release its progeny. And parasites are transmitted from one person to another by blood-sucking female Anopheles mosquitoes. And there are about 50 different species of Anopheles mosquito around the world that are capable of transmitting malaria to humans, and there are other anopheles that don't transmit malaria. In terms of modeling and understanding evolution, it's important to understand that the parasite is haploid for most of its life cycle. I should say a little bit about the parasite genome. The parasite genome is, P. falciparum genome is about 23 megabases. It has 5,000 genes, so it's a highly condensed genome. About half of the genome is coding. And it's remarkably AT-rich. Overall, it's about 80% AT content across the genome. And in the non-coding regions, that goes up to getting on for 90%. And that's a rather remarkable feature of the genome, but it also makes sequencing of the genome very difficult. So that's the genome I'm talking about. In terms of its biology, it's haploid for most of its life cycle. It's passing between humans and mosquitoes. What's happening in humans is those haploid forms are undergoing asexual replication, primarily in red cells, although there is initially a phase of replication in the liver. But most of that replication is going on in red cells. So if you see an individual, a malaria infection will start with the inoculation of something in the general order, maybe of 100 haploid parasites from the bite of an infected mosquito. The number can vary. We don't know the exact numbers, but probably in the order of 10 to 100 often. And they're going to replicate up asexually, and they're going to go into the liver, then they're going to burst out of the liver and go into the red blood cells, where there's going to be an exponential growth phase of haploid asexual division. And by the time you get in the general order of a billion parasites inside the body, several billion, the person starts to get ill. They start to get fevers, and those fevers are associated with the parasites bursting out of the red cells. At that point, a small proportion of those asexually replicating parasites are going to they're going to produce progeny that actually aren't capable of asexual replication. They're sexual forms that just go around in the blood. And while they're in the human, they're doing nothing. But when those are taken up by the bite of a mosquito, a blood-sucking mosquito, those sexual forms then burst out of the red cells and mate with each other inside the mosquito gut. And that's when recombination happens. And so then...
Does that mean that we have an idea how many different sources a mosquito picks it up?
Probably a single individual, mostly.
So well, most in fact... Of the time, sisters mate.
Well, that's another question. It's parasites from the same individual mating that you're jumping ahead to ask, because the first question, your assumption is that the parasites inside a single individual are related to each other, which may not be true, so we'll come to that. Because Let's just pursue that, because it's a deep question, so we'll pursue it right now. So you're someone in Africa, and 10 mosquitoes have bitten you. Actually, in many parts of Africa, 1,000 infected mosquitoes have bitten you in the last year. So by definition, you're going to have a lot of genetic mixing. And when the mosquito then samples you as an individual, there's the opportunity for outcrossing of those norms.
So you're telling me that in endemic regions, most people are chronically infected and continuously sort of repopulated.
Yes.
With new malaria.
Exactly. Now, how that translates to what goes on when you're sampled by a mosquito turns out to be a result of many things. How many times you were bitten, whether you were bitten by mosquitoes that had a clonal parasite or actually themselves were carrying, because you get diversity propagated through a population. If that goes on through multiple generations, it starts to be that a single infected mosquito bite has genetic diversity. So there's all those factors. And part of it is actually to do with population dynamics, because actually some clones will be replicating much faster in that individual than others. And then you may indeed get sibling mating because they're dominating the population.
Yes, they're almost saying, to what extent is one of those things, or to what extent
I'm hoping you're going to tell me this week. That's why I came here. But there's a fascinating mix here of population dynamics and population genetics.
Yeah, I see that all these things can happen.
All right.
But has one done sort of deep sequencing within patients?
Well, that's what I'm going to start talking about that. So that was just, I normally show the slide at the end of my talk, but I thought for you guys it was important to say it at the beginning. And actually, I'm going to go a bit deeper. I'm spending much longer on the slide than I normally would, but I just want you to understand what's really incredibly exciting about malaria.
Yeah,
it
could be.
So I'm going to talk about, so what's happening in here is I've already told you we've got a pool of billions of parasites which are undergoing intra-host competition. What we've got is a pool of potentially genetic diverse parasites that are competing with each other. A few are going to make it through into a mosquito, and then a few are going to make it through into the next human. Massive bottleneck. That's an extraordinarily unusual, it has some parallels with other microbial genetics, but it is a fairly unique structure in terms of, you know, how then evolution would evolve. Because of this massive phase, intra-host competition here, this huge bottleneck, followed by a recombination event that then reinjects. Okay? So that's what I think is open to modeling. And I'm not sure many people, a few people, but not many people have really captured that in models. Anyway, I'm back to basics now. So as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of millions of people are infected with malaria throughout the world. And this gives a sense of how many people are carrying parasites at any one time. You can see that in much of sub-Saharan Africa, over 50% of children are carrying parasites at any given point in time, which means to say that all of them are infected at some point in the year. And I mentioned earlier, my opening slide was to say that, you know, over 600,000 individuals each year die of malaria. They're mainly children living in sub-Saharan Africa, but they're only a minority of the total number of infected individuals. So in the general order, about 1% of infections are fatal. In the 50s, there was a lot of optimism that malaria could be eradicated. Chloroquine had been invented as a highly effective, safe, easy-to-use anti-malarial drug, and DDT was a highly effective insecticide. But by the 90s, that optimism had shifted to massive gloom for multiple reasons, but not least because the parasite had become resistant to chloroquine and the mosquitoes had become resistant to the insecticide. And I'm not going to talk about the mosquitoes at all in this talk, but we are also working on that, and I'd be happy to talk about that later.
So this geographical distribution is just primarily climatic, or because it's sort of lower in the Amazon?
Firstly, I'm not. Don't think anyone understands all the ecological factors, and I certainly don't. But I think it's primarily the climatic distribution that favours the two things. Firstly, the replication of mosquitoes, these anomalous mosquitoes, and you know they like, for example, many of them like to breed in small freshwater pools, and they like, you know, when there's been a lot of rain recently. And then it's also determined by the factors that determine the replication of the parasite inside the mosquito. So warmer is good because the parasites replicate faster, because the mosquito then has to bite the next person before they die. You see what I mean? So what's going to happen is they're going to bite an individual, then the parasites are going to mate, they're going to undergo asexual recombination, they're going to replicate over a couple of weeks or so, and then they're going to get injected into a new person. The mosquito has to live that long. So hot is good, but hot dry is not great, because hot dry, the mosquitoes die sooner. So it's a combination of breeding conditions, water in the ground, humidity, temperature, and so on.
So with that respect, it doesn't seem to be that it needs to be so hot if Europe had also.
No, that's right. I mean, in fact, I gather that a century ago, malaria was only not in about 6 countries. I may have got the number slightly wrong, but on the order of magnitude of 10 countries was the number of malaria-free countries a century ago.
You've got malaria in southern Chile, which is quite
cold. Yeah, well, anyone here an expert on malaria in southern Chile? I don't.
I think it's just the way the map appears with the amount of inlets and islands down there.
I mean, one place, for example, and this map isn't a great map, you can't see here, but I'll show you, I'll have to show you another slide, but if I show you this country here, I don't really recognize it, because it's only partially shown on that. It's called the United States of America. You'd see that there were not only perfect climatic conditions for malaria, but actually extraordinarily viable mosquito species, particularly around sort of Florida areas, certainly in San Diego, there was an outbreak relatively recently. Sacramento Valley used to be absolutely full of malaria. So, you know, California's a great place. I'm not quite sure about Santa Barbara, but certainly Sacramento was a really great place for it. So there's the climatic conditions for it, and actually there are viable species. So anyway, point is, this is where it is right now. Now, I mentioned drug resistance, and here's just a bit of an animation to show you how resistance to chloroquine spread. This is a time scale going from the 50s through to the current day, and what you're seeing here is the spread of resistance, firstly to chloroquine in the sort of turquoisey color, and then to the next frontline antimalarial drug, sulfadoxin permethamine in yellow, and then to both of them in purple. And you can see that over the last 50 years or so, resistance to both has spread across the globe. And that's been very depressing. The good news is that there now is another highly effective antimalarial that's widely used as a frontline drug, artemisinin, and it's given in combination with other drugs to reduce the risk of resistance emerging. Bad news is that resistance to artemisinin is now spreading out from Western Cambodia. And the curious thing is that in all three cases I've just illustrated to you, chloroquine, sulfadoxin, pyrimethamine, and artemisinin, the epicenter, the emergence of resistance was in Western Cambodia. Now, just to clarify that point, it's quite clear in the previous rounds of resistance, there were multicentric origins of resistance. I'm not saying it can't happen anywhere else. I'm just saying the dominant epicenter, where it really established a stronghold and from which it then spread out, was the area of Cambodia. So that's an interesting thing. And we'll come on, I'll just repeat what I just said. I'm trying to disambiguate two things. Where can mutations emerge? That's thing number one. And the other is, where do they really take root and really spread from? Second thing. Okay. So now, I'm a genomics guy. Recently I've been a genomics guy. And so I'm actually going to not give you an evolutionary perspective of this. We'll come to that at the end. I want to give you more just a genomic landscape perspective. You know, what does... So next portion of my talk is not about drug resistance at all. It's just about what goes on in the genome. How does the genome... And I'm going to sort of deal with sort of 5 separate points. What's the rate of de novo mutation? What's the, you know, given that when... the rate of de novo mutation, what does that translate to when you look across the genome in terms of where do you see variation? Then, to flip from the genome to the population, how variable is the population? And then we want to get onto questions like how the population is evolving in real time and how we can maybe use some of that and apply tools to help with malaria control and elimination. So, to work out the de novo mutation rate, it's very difficult to work this out from population-based data, and we've had to set up some very painstaking experiments in the lab, and this has been led by a PhD student, Will Hamilton, and postdoc, Anton Clesson at Sanger, who've done an extraordinary piece of work, growing up clones of parasites, building clone trees where you clone a parasite, you grow it up for about a month, then you subclone it, you sequence the subclones, and then you grow each of those up through successive generations. And they've built up clone trees, well, there are 2 million clones now.
This is done in mammalian cell culture?
It's done in red cells. They're grown in red cells. And it's painful because of, I mean, if you could just plate it on agar plate, it'd be dead cinch. You just pitch up and then you go surfing or something. But but actually, it's not like that. You have to maintain these red cell cultures and you have to feed them.
So essentially, you're running an education and commission
there. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. So without, and this is work that's under review, but here's the bottom line. We can work out that the probability of de novo mutation each position in the genome in each cycle of replication in the red cell, which takes 48 hours, is around 3 × 10⁻¹. And a patient with malaria fever carries billions of parasite erythrocytes, which are replicating every 48 hours. That's to say, the parasite invades a red cell, replicates and develops, and then it builds out of the red cell, and loses its progeny 48 hours later. So if we then just do some simple maths, if we take a mutation rate of 3 × 10⁻¹ and assume that people have on the order of 3 times, have on the order of 10 to the 10 parasites inside their body, you can see that the parasite is generating new mutation at every position in the genome, approximately every couple of days in a single infected individual. Just for interest, I know this is not the main point focus of this, group, but for those who are interested in immunology and antigenic variation, the parasite does have some highly polymorphic gene families, the VAR genes, for example. And it turns out these undergo non-allelic recombination during this process. So we can see that they create tens of millions of new antigenic forms every couple of days as well. They do this by this process of non-allelic recombination. This is the 14, which I'm showing here, are the 14 chromosomes of falciparum. Here you're seeing one particular clone tree, and you're seeing in these, on this plot, you're seeing non-allelic combination between different positions, between VAR genes at different positions of the genome. And it turns out, that turns out to be a highly structured process. There's a highly non-allelic combination, but in such a way that despite the fact that the recombining forms have only about 50% sequencer identity, nevertheless they do it in a highly structured way that preserves the functional domain architecture, and there's clearly some machinery doing that which we don't fully understand. Bottom line of this last couple of slides is the parasite is perfectly capable of generating massive diversity when it wants to, but actually this is to do with antigenic variation. When we talk about drug resistance, this sort of machinery doesn't exist for that.
So in the mutation accumulation line, does that provide you with any hints why is the AT content so biased?
It does indeed, yeah. I'm not going to talk about that right now, but indeed it shows exactly that the AT content is exactly what you'd expect it to be.
And what's the estimated generation time in an infection?
Generation time meaning?
How many replications? So putting together the per base mutation rate and the population size, we also need to know how many mitotic divisions there are.
Yeah, it's difficult to quantify. I'll give you the basics and you can work it out for yourself. It turns out to be difficult to do precisely. So the parasite has a generation time within a red cell of almost exactly 48 hours. That's pretty constant, plus or minus a few hours. The question is how many progeny it produces in that time, and the actual mechanism by which it generates those progeny. And the bottom line is it generates something on the order of maybe 10 to 20 progeny. And then there's the question of exactly how many of those, you know, the process by which it gets to those 20. And there are a few assumptions you have to make, but you can work out orders of magnitude what it would be from those numbers I've just given you.
But the lifespan is a couple of days in red blood cells, is that what you're...
The life cycle within a red cell, not the lifespan, the life cycle of a parasite that goes from invasion to release of progeny is 48 hours.
I see. Yes.
One invades, 10 to 20 come out 48 hours later. And from that you can work out an approximate answer to your question.
Yeah.
Very difficult to work out an exact answer to your question.
And they do it like lytic phage do, they destroy it, like lytic viruses do, they destroy the red blood cell.
Yeah.
the reason that it assembled inside.
And then invade another one.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm now going to move from. I'm probably going to need to speed up at some point. But I'm now going to move from asking about mutation to asking about what imprint that leaves on the genome. So if we now compared any two unrelated parasites, how many differences would we see and where would they be in the genome? That also turns out to be quite a difficult question to address, because if they're unrelated, we then rely on considerable fidelity in our sequence information. And I just told you with 80% AT content, it's rather difficult to assemble a genome with great fidelity. So giving a precise answer to this question is somewhat non-trivial, but the way we're approaching, and we have a number of experiments, and I'll talk about a number of projects in place right now to give a very exact answer to this question, but I'm just going to talk about one particular approach. Everything I'm talking about in the previous few slides on these is unpublished data, where in this case we do Illumina sequencing and combine reference-based and de novo assemblies, and specifically what we sequence are the progeny of three genetic crosses, where in each case the genetic cross, two parents have been allowed to mate and to recombine and produce progeny, and then we sequence in each case about 20 progeny from that cross. Now there are only four genetic crosses in existence. We've done three and we're about to, we have sequenced three of them and we're about to sequence the fourth. They've all been performed at NIH, largely by the group of Tom Wellems. They were set up initially by David Wallacher and Richard Carter quite a long time ago, and then Tom Wellems has pursued this area. They're completely non-trivial to do, because you have to passage the parasites through a chimpanzee, because you have to get it through the liver stage of infection, and there's no experimental model of that. So short of doing it in a human, you have to do it in a chimpanzee. So it's very difficult to do these crosses, but we're very fortunate to have the samples from those crosses and to have been able to sequence them. So the sort of now the advantage of doing this, of course, is that we can build a combination map. So here in blue, you're seeing the schematic of the genome of one of the parents, and in red, another of the parents, and here you can see the 14 chromosomes of the parasite and different recombination points. But the really important thing for us is that with this experiment, we can sort of work out when we're getting it right and when we're getting it wrong by the Mendelian error rate. Because if we find that our sequence data in the progeny differ wildly from what we would have expected given the parents, so for example, if we see lots of variants that aren't present in the parents, we can work out that must be a difficult area of the genome to sequence. So importantly, it provides us a fantastic way of doing QC on our data, and then from that QC, optimizing our discovery process, so we can actually start to produce quite accurate maps. So in the general order of this, this is just orders of magnitude, there's on the general order of about 10,000 segregating sites between any two unrelated individuals, if you exclude the highly variable regions, which we're not able to get at the moment. And there's on the order of 20,000 to 30,000 indels in each. So actually it's quite interesting, the indel rate is much higher than we'd expect in most species. Indels are actually much more common than SNPs. And that's probably a product of this very high AT content. There's lots of opportunity for...
Do you get rearrangements going on as well?
You do. I just told you earlier about the non-allelic recombination of our genes. And we've systematically explored that, and that's a very prolific process. There are possibly a few other things going on. But we haven't managed to drill down, apart from something I'm going to show you on the next slide or two.
What do you define as an indel here?
Great question. In this case, it's talking about mainly short tandem repeats. So, dinucleotide, trinucleotide repeats.
Are you talking about small indels or anyway?
This is largely small ones. We haven't really got into the larger stuff. Actually, I'll show you a bit we know about the larger stuff, which will partly address your question in a minute. But we haven't. It's not something we've looked at systematically.
Can you elaborate a little bit on this Mendelian error rate?
You can just apply some simple algorithms. You can say, for example, I'll just give a simple use case. Do I see an allele in the progeny that was not present in either of the parents? Now, clearly, that could be due to de novo mutation. But when you see an accumulation of those at certain locations, you can then sort of just do some simple common sense and say, is this due to a very high de novo mutation rate in this location, or is it because I'm just getting the wrong genotype cause in this area? And this gives us flags of regions of the genome where we start to see very high error rates. There are other, if you just go through the process I've said, you can work out another algorithm that basically allows you to sanity check your data.
Is it possible that one misses some hypervariable regions that way and some gene conversion effects or whatnot?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. But obviously there's a certain point where it becomes an unproductive process, what I just said. When you're faced with a genome that's almost completely, has massive error rates, where you're finding millions of SNPs and you know most of them are crap, and there's no way you're going to pass the reviewer, your first challenge is to say, do I believe it? Once you can convince your peers and your reviewers you believe what you're seeing, then you can go into the space of, what did I throw away that was good? You begin by throwing away crap, then you start by retrieving what was good.
And Dominic, can you go one slide back? So, we have looked at this kind of cross data in a completely different order in yeast, and we see that there's quite a bit of selection going on during the cross, and I basically see that one of those chromosomes is more blue than red. So there's been some selection. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I would like to think so. I mean, I don't know, we often, that's all obviously what we're always hoping to do, and find evidence of basically transmission distortion, for example, evidence that the progeny are carrying a bias for one allele. And actually, I was interested in transmission distortion well over 10 years ago, so I've always been a bit obsessed by it. The trouble is, with numbers here, it's very difficult to convince yourself unless you see extreme events. So the answer is, we see sort of trends, but nothing I don't think at this point we can write up.
So, for this 78 GV4 cross, I thought that there was quite a clear example of transmission distortion, either around RH5 or EBA1.
Yes, I think you might be right about that, Ian, actually. Yeah. I don't know how. I think that's right. The RH5 probably is. I'm not sure about the RH. Sorry, I'll have to. My answer was a slightly general one to Villa. You know, when we run genome scans and say, do we see massive numbers of outliers? We don't see sort of bulk phenomena. That was more my point. But you're right in that cross. I think Tom Mullins did talk about that, didn't he? Yeah, that's right. So here's just a sense of what we get out of this in terms of the genomic landscape of variation. You can see that for much of the genome, it's pretty boring, actually. If we compare any two unrelated individuals, if we look at nucleotide diversity, we get figures on the general order of 10^-3, which is sort of the same as humans. It's pretty boring because in mosquitoes it's more like 10^-2. In fact, it's sometimes even higher than 10^-2, so this is tame stuff. But you do see that even outside the so-called hypervariable regions that I was talking about earlier, the var genes, there are little islands of massive diversity, and some of those, if you then work out what genes are in those islands, they're typically genes involved in the process of erythrocyte invasion. And probably a large part of the driver of that diversity, maybe not all of it, is the immune response of the host. And then this was really just to, in a sense, it gets at some of the questions earlier about structural variation. Here's a particular locus where we see very interesting clear morphic copy number variation. I'll tell you what it's not. So in some regions we see copy number variation where there was clearly a single origin of a copy number variation propagated through the population. This thing is very diverse in its form, in its structure, in its form, very variable, and it seems to be just cropping up all over the place. So this seems to be a locus that lots of stuff is just going on. But it's not something we've studied in massive detail. Bottom line is the genome is pretty, despite this all mutations going on, the genome for the most part is pretty boring, and that's presumably because of purifying selection and various things like that. Now, the next, I'm going to speed through the next few slides just to understand, so you understand where we get, you know, where data is being generated and where you can find data and how the communities come together to generate data. So for some time we've been coordinating a thing called a Mlerjan community project on Plasmodium falciparum, and where multiple groups around the world, and here I've named some but not all of them, have generously contributed samples. The deal is that they contribute samples, Sanger, the DNA is sequenced, the group, contributing groups get back data, sequencing data and genotype calls on the data, which then they can use for their own experiments, but they contribute the data to a sort of common pool where we produce catalogues of allele variation around the world and start to do some global population genetic analyses. And it's been a challenge to put this project together, not just because of the technical issues around sequencing, some of which I've mentioned, but also because, you know, this is all work in progress. Pretty much all of the groups mentioned here are doing their own are interested themselves in genome variation. So there's a sort of a balance that has to be struck between doing stuff that allows the community to access the data and make it as open and accessible as possible, and the fact that most of these groups haven't yet finished using the data. And so we've been trying to understand how you build those sorts of collaborative data sharing structures. It's somewhat different from working in human genetics, where the dynamics are very different. I mean, one thing you'll note here is many of these people are in poor malaria endemic countries. They're not scientists sitting with massive computing abilities. So we have to make sure that our partners are contributing data aren't gazumped on the experiments they're trying to do with possibly less computing capacity than someone sitting here in Central Park. Anyway, if you just Google the Mlerjan website, you'll find a link to this project. It's in the top right-hand corner, and you can find a web application that takes you around, gives you a little bit of a tour of some of the locations where parasites are being sampled, and the investigators that are working at those locations, and the studies they're doing, and something about the uses to which they are putting to the data. And then you can find the specific loci allele frequency distributions in different places. But more interestingly, just easily searchable lists where you can sort of look at all the variants that have been declared. So in the current release, I think it's 600,000. We're just about to release a list which has 1 million variants, most of which are rare, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But you can look up each of them, you can find out things about it, and you can query for its frequency in different locations, and you can look for those that are highly differentiated. Here's a tool that not on the current website, but actually it's about to release in a slightly different application, which I'll talk about. It's a way of browsing the genotype calls on individual samples. So in this case, each individual row is an individual sample. Here are different variants being called across the gene. In this case, it's the gene the main gene responsible for chloroquine resistance, the PFCRT gene. Here are variants, and here are the variant calls at each location. And you'll see there's, in this case, in this very well-studied gene, there's large areas of white, which means to say we're not confident in our calls, and that might seem very strange because chloroquine isn't inherently one of the hypervariable antigenic genes, and it's been studied probably more than any other Plasmodium gene, so why should it be so difficult to call? And it turns out that it has, over the last 50 years, been under a lot of evolutionary pressure, and it's gathered an awful lot of complex variation that's rather difficult to interpret with short-read data without a lot of additional algorithmic processes. And on this view of the data, it gives you a sense of, for any given locus, what the quality of the data is, and gives you a sense of whether a region will be easy or difficult to call. Now, what I've shown you we're very proud of it, but it's still not complete. It's not really completely satisfactory because it's certainly not a complete, comprehensive analysis of variation across the whole genome. It misses out these rather variable regions. So we've just launched a new project called PF3K, which includes many samples from the previous project I mentioned. It's an open access genome variation project, and the aim is to get as close as we can to a complete genome sequence for 3,000 samples, using every tool in the book. And part of that is using new technologies, long reads, for example, on new technologies, but also by new analytical approaches, combining methods of de novo assembly with alignment, and also by building a fairly large number of reference genomes, so putting a lot of effort into sequencing, say 100 or so samples, which will then be used to provide a better framework for reference-based alignment. This website is now launched. It's not very prominent. I can give you the URL later if you're interested. It's an open access project, but like the Human Thousand Genomes project and like the Malaria Community project, we rely on people to sort of use the data responsibly and obey Fort Lauderdale conditions, because it's been a vast amount of work setting it up, and it's not sustainable if people use the open access data and then gazump the investigators on the prime product. So we spent a long time trying to understand how we get that balance right between defining what will be the scientific outputs and publications of this consortium and what is just openly accessible and anyone can publish what they want on it. Anyway, you can browse it, and there's a few nice features that I'm happy to demo later if anyone's interested. Anyway, I now have, I think, 15 minutes to talk about the main talk. That was all intro, but I think I've covered it. I'm glad I've sort of dealt with, if you like, the architecture of variation, because I think that's the fundamental thing you need for modeling. The rest is, in a sense, particular sort of use cases of that.
Well, but we're very patient and we're very interested, so don't feel you have to cut yourself off at 60 minutes.
Okay, thanks. Well, anyway, let me now give you a few sort of sound bites that come out of all this looking at the data. So now we're moving to what is going on in the natural population. My earlier stuff was what are the underlying drivers, what's going on in the natural population. So the first thing is a lot of rare variants circulating in Africa. And this, for example, is showing for each of the samples we've sequenced recently, how many new variants do we find with every sample we sequence. And it still hasn't plateaued, and you can see it running at about 200 to 300 new variants per sample when you're in Africa. But if we go to other regions of the world, like Southeast Asia, we find far fewer new variants.
There are two reasons, right? So you could either have sequenced more stuff already in South America or in Southeast Asia, or there could be a genuine difference in the lipid spectrum.
Yeah, we've sequenced roughly the same number. So this is a slide from Roberto. Roberto will probably show this later in his talk, and we'll talk about it more extensively. But this is the allele frequency spectrum, where we can see a similar number of common variants. This is variants of more than 1% in both Africa and Southeast Asia, but far fewer rare variants. And this is from sequencing a couple thousand in each of the locations, fundamentally, roughly. So there's a difference. Now, you know, I leave it to you to tell us what the underlying causes of this, because I'm sure you can see into the evolution more deeply than I can, but factors could include the fact that the parasite originated in Africa and underwent large population expansions there and accumulated a lot of variants before moving out to other places like Southeast Asia, where it probably went through many demographic bottlenecks. So this may be partly a result of bottlenecking on ancient diversity. It's also true that the transmission rates are typically much higher in Africa, and with a high, very high transmission rate, you actually allow for much more ongoing population expansion, and I think allow for the accumulation of rare variants more. And there may be other factors as well. But this I think is a very fundamental slide in terms of working out what's going on here in evolution, because what I've told you already is every position in the genome is mutating in every individual. So the question is, what's happening to those rare variants? And what's happening is they're being found in the general population in Africa, but they're not being found in the general population of Southeast Asia. And I'm just putting it to you that there's going to be two classes of reasons for that. One class of region is ancient. It's to do with demographic process, ancient demographic process, population expansion, and the other is going to be recent. And you have to tell me which is the important one.
I think this is really quite interesting, because it is not exactly compatible with the bottleneck model. Bottleneck model would explain why there's much less diversity, but it would also predict that you actually have an excess of rare frequency alleles after the recovery of the bottleneck. And if that was during the migration out of Africa, it should have been long ago that you should see that. So it's
I think getting good modeling of this is important. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff in here that one could do. Yeah. I mean, I think Roberta is particularly interested in this sort of question. By the way, I think there's multiple possible reasons for this, so I don't think we should restrict ourselves just to the two things we'll say. Anyway, the next thing to say is that the diversity we see has a structure. So this is a neighbor-joining tree. It's Roberta, I think, will show a more recent version with more samples and more variants, but this is based on 1,600 samples where we found 400,000 SNPs, and then we think Roberto and Oliver will have filtered this for variants that were probably more than 5% frequency or so to build a neighborhood tree. And what you can see fundamentally is that on a neighbor joining tree, you can distinguish parasites that are from Africa on the left-hand side and from Southeast Asia on the right-hand side, and you can distinguish parasites from West Africa and East Africa. And as we build up this neighbor joining tree, as I say, this is a rather old version, it just is beautiful. You get a lovely, lovely picture. And we can see that, for example, parasites in South America are more related to the parasites from Africa, and they have a long branch, implying that there's been a long period of differentiation, but they come rooted from the same sort of ancestry. As the map gets built out, we start to see that the branching structure is somewhat different in a low transmission area like Southeast Asia than it is in Africa. There's more opportunity for isolation of parasites, little islands of parasites in a low transmission area. Does that make sense? If you're working in an area of very high transmission, then parasites are being mixed all over the place. Where if you're in an area of low transmission, you get a pocket of parasites that is never ever connected with another pocket of parasites in a village nearby. Does that make sense? So there's much more opportunity then for some inbreeding that gives a more fragmented population structure. But this isn't necessarily the best way of depicting that. It's just illustrative.
Yeah.
Can I ask, between the internal nodes, and what sort of distance do you have on that? Imagine how many SNPs would a given?
I don't know, top of my head. Like a picture.
The thing that interested us a couple of years ago was when we saw this PCA plot in principal components analysis of these data. And we could see that all the parasites in Africa, despite their diversity, were also clustering together, as were most of the parasites in Southeast Asia. But spewing out from that were a whole bunch of parasites with a very unusual, who were accounting for a lot of the variants. And they were all from Western Cambodia. And actually, when we first saw it, we thought we must have made an error or just mixed up samples or done something wrong to them. But it turned out to be true. And
this is some kind of PCA on the genetic diversity?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Genetic diversity is just matrix. That means PCA.
And it was
much more sensible as a tree, right? Because there's lots of recombination going on.
Believe me, when you do trees and PCAs for a long time, you realize that neither of them are particularly good. So the task for this week, construct a good way of doing this. Anyway, point is that those parasites were from this region of Western Cambodia, which has been the global epicenter of artemisinin resistance. And what we discovered when we looked at other ways of, looking at population structure, I think this is the admixture program, but it would give a similar plot if you looked at the structure program or whatever. We could see that there were a number of different compartments of population structure, and over here is a compartment of parasites that looked like parasites throughout Southeast Asia, and they're sensitive to artemisinin. Over here are three what we call founder populations, because they're extraordinarily differentiated groups, with each of them is highly differentiated from the others by FST, and they're artemisinin resistant. And then there's a group of parasites that are a mixture of them. And I won't bore you with all the details. If you want, if you're interested, you can read this paper in Nature Genetics last year that described it. And worked out was that there are multiple strains of artemisinin-resistant parasites circulating in Western Cambodia, each of which had the genetic characteristics of a founder population, a group of parasites found by a small number of individuals that had recently undergone population expansion. And we worried about this a lot, and it took us a long time for the penny to drop, but we're pretty certain that what we're seeing here, and I, there's more data than I'm showing you, but what we're seeing here is the signature of what happens if you've got a, I mean, I'll give you an example in this room. Let's just say one of you decided that you were going to just replicate like crazy. So I come into the room, now you're all fairly different, but I sort of go out for a coffee and I come back and, you know, I see 10 copies of you, but all the rest of you are sort of just the same. That's just sort of, it doesn't meet the null hypothesis. You know, it somehow deviates from null. And, you know, that's just, and what's happened here, the only explanation for that is that you developed massive, powerful replication potential, which defies normal biology. But anyway, but in this case, we think this is a signature of what happens when a parasite strain goes rampant through the population. And you can think of that by looking at any sort of set of markers that's, you know, that is registered a unique marker. So with Roberto, particularly been thinking about ways to detect this expansion of strains using more using simpler techniques than genome sequencing. And here's an example of a newfound population of artemisinin-resistant parasites in southern Vietnam. These are parasites in general in southern Vietnam, and these are essentially look more or less clonal, even though they're taken from around the place. They're not all taken from the same location, so it's a clone that's sort of gone rampant. Now, the penny dropped the later part of last year, December, when Frédéric Arrier and colleagues from Institut Pasteur, in Paris and also in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, published a lovely paper describing what seems to be as close as we can get right now to the cause of artemisinin resistance, the artemisinin resistance we're seeing right now. They did an experimental adaptation. In the lab, they sort of bred a parasite to be artemisinin resistant over several years by feeding cultured parasites with more and more, progressively more and more artemisinin, and they bred an artemisinin-resistant strain, and then they sequenced all the parasites on that journey. They knew from some data actually from Ian and Tim and others and from other groups that they were looking for something in the region of chromosome 13, because Tim et al. Had done an interesting, not exactly a GWAS, but something approaching a genome-wide association study, your own variation of a genome-wide association study.
Which you'll talk about later,
yes. So they had quite a few clues, and they put together the experimental data, and they said, this particular gene, so-called Kelch gene, the chromosome 13, looks as though it could be the cause of artemisinin resistance. And then they went to Cambodia, and they sequenced artemisinin-resistant parasites, and they found, indeed, that multiple mutations in this locus all seem to independently confer artemisinin resistance. Now, it's a really stunning finding because what all of these mutations are happening in a particular structural domain of this particular of this protein, so-called propeller domain. It's got this highly ordered structure. And the interesting thing is that it's not a single mutation that's doing it. They're finding multiple mutations that each appear to be conferring parasite delayed parasite clearance, which is the clinical measure of artemisinin resistance. So we began to realize that a large part of the driver of these founder populations that we discovered were these Kelch mutations, which were then driving, they were the driver mutations of a founder population. It's probably a little bit more complex than that, but that's the sort of simple bottom line. So now we've been engaged in a large multi-center genome-wide association study with the TRAC collaboration, Tracking Resistance to Artemisinin Consortium, led by Mahabir Oxford Research Unit in Bangkok, and particularly by Liz Ashley and Nick White and colleagues, and linking in that in with work with other groups, particularly Rick Fairhurst's group at NIH. He's been doing a lot of work in Cambodia with colleagues there, and putting that together into a large genome-wide association population genetic study of what's going on with artemisinin resistance. And this is just a summary slide. I'm going to talk in details about some aspects of it. As I mentioned, TRAC is a multi-center clinical study. We've got data on about 1,000 patients treated with artemisinin, and it's asking how quickly they clear their parasites from the blood after treatment with artemisinin. We did genome sequencing on all those samples, analyzed about 600,000 SNPs, and here's a Manhattan plot of the genome-wide association study. And to fast forward, what I'm going to tell you is that it is clear that this Kelch 13 locus is the major locus of artemisinin resistance, but it turns out to be just a bit more complex and interesting than that, because there are some other hits. So this cartoon shows the On the y-axis, on the vertical axis here, you're seeing the parasite clearance time, that's to say how long it took to clear parasites from the blood after treatment with artemisinin. So high values are bad, low values are good. And this, what you're seeing down here, is what we'd expect the normal parasite clearance half-life to be. It's in the general order of 3 hours. And what you're seeing here is parasites with prolonged parasite clearance, and each of these bars represents the data for a particular mutation in the structural domain of the protein. And you can see that all of these mutations in the propeller domain and an adjacent domain called the BTP pos domain have prolonged parasite clearance. And so very clear evidence that these mutations are associated with resistance, and that by and large any mutation in this domain is going to give some level of resistance. There may be some level of heterogeneity in that. So for example, you ask what's going on with these values here, these mutations here, but by and large, all of those mutations in the propeller domain are giving resistance.
And how is that assessed? How is the y-axis measured?
Clinically, it can be assessed in two ways. This was done clinically, a patient rolls up to clinic with malaria.
These are the effects of these mutations averaged over all backgrounds. So for example, a patient won't do the favor of showing up only with D335Y. Right? That mutation will be embedded in more complexity, or does every patient show up with only one of these mutations on average?
I think I'm right. You're right to say that we find very little evidence of mixture. Well, I think I'll answer your main question first, not a small question. I think your main question is, what have we done here? What we've done here is we've just said, when we sequence the genome, what do we see at this particular locus? Do we see a mutation or not?
Yeah.
And in general, we're either going to find wild type or one of these mutations.
Okay.
Good. And then we're just going to plot it on here.
Good. Okay.
Thank
you very much.
Yep. Sorry, have you ever seen more than one mutation? So we haven't.
Well, I don't think we have, but because we've done more recently, Roberto may.
No. Only one sample, we're not sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting.
Very interesting, yeah.
So Dominic, now that you have kind of, you and the others have identified this to be there, the most important or interesting region, can you go back and try to sequence a large number of samples for variants in this region, and would you have something like the fraction of population as a function of time, so that you would see an idea of the spread dynamics of this mutation for the population? Because you've shown us kind of a snapshot of samples, and it's not easy to see the fraction.
Well, can you ask that question again after my next slides? I mean, I think the answer is that many groups are trying to do that. I'm going to give you one perspective on your question, but your question is quite a deep question, and others are working on other aspects of it. So, now this is a pretty sort of population genetic-y slide, so for those of you who don't think in these terms, you might be a bit baffled. But what we're trying to show, now let me just, I have to look at it carefully. So, we're trying to say several things on this slide. So firstly, we're sampling across this region of Southeast Asia. And do you know something? I think there's an easier way of showing this. I'll come back to the slide later, because there's a... No, I'm going to do this one. So what we're showing here in these colors, so for example, blue here, we're showing parasites sampled from Myanmar on the western fringe of the region. And then here in red, we're seeing western Cambodia. What we're doing is we're plotting those samples on the neighbor joining tree. And what you can see is there's a compartment in terms of population genetics. There's a population genetic compartment that corresponds to Myanmar. Does that make sense at the genome-wide level? What this is sort of saying is that these parasites here in Myanmar are somewhat isolated, for example, from these parasites here in purple, which in Bangladesh. We can see a distinct population compartment.
Yeah, but the distance is tiny, right? So the two things from Bangladesh are just about the same distance from each other as one from Myanmar and one from Bangladesh. it's just sort of this tiny little branch that at the very base there that separates Bangladeshi isolates from those from Myanmar.
Well, I can see it feels tiny to you. I just don't know how tiny it feels to a parasite.
So what sort of pairwise, you know, you align two things, having distance between two Bangladeshi isolates and two Myanmar isolates on the cross distance?
Well, it's a good question. It's a great question. And I think there's many things I'd love to explore in your question, but just let me walk you through. I'm sorry, I haven't presented this slide necessarily in the best way. Let's just start with basic questions. 101. Question number one, are all the parasites in this region mixed up a completely amorphous mess? No, they're not. They clearly have some level of structure. At this point, we aren't going to say how much structure. It's just that basically the blue ones congregate together, the purple ones congregate together, the red ones to a first approximation congregate together. That's the first key point. It's not an amorphous mess. Example, if this was West Africa, it would just be a big splurge. True, Alfred.
True.
Okay? So that's a deep observation. You're now going to the micro details of that. Now, you're trying to get at a question I want to ask you later, which is tell me the level of mixing. You work out, you know, if I give you the data, I want now to know, I'm actually not interested in FST. I want to know what's the rate of diffusion and migration of parasites between here and here. That's the interesting question. And that's that's what we've got to work out. You're sort of saying, based on this thing here, you're probably asserting that you think there is migration across there. That's what your question translates to. Well, and I'd like to understand that.
So the question is the utility of making a SNP-based tree in a recombined population, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many. Well, give us a better way right now. But right now, we're asking for is a simple, no-brainer way of knowing is, are the parasites massively mixing or not? And the answer is, whatever they're doing, they're not mixing freely. And I can tell you, if we did that for West Africa, they would be mixing pretty freely. So it's telling us something. And now the question is, how we derive from this migration statistics? And I tell you, we don't do it by neighbor-joining trees. Okay. But we have to do first questions first. So first question is, are they freely mixing? Answer, no. Next question is, you know, can you assign them to geographic compartments? What's stopping them mixing? And the thing stopping them mixing to a first approximation probably is geography. Okay. And now the next question is, when we start to map mutations onto this population structure, do we find mutations crossing population boundaries? Boundaries of and the answer is, yes, we find mutations in several of the population compartments, but not in others. We're now, you know, at a later point, we're going to work out why that's happening. Now, the next question is, when we see...
If you go back, is that divergence that you see there, is that spread out over the genome, or is that localized in a given part?
It's a great question, actually. I'm going to say I think we're going to find it's pretty spread out, but you're quite right that, you know, looking... Obviously, a deep question we're asking in our scans is, what you're really asking is, do we find particular regions of the genome where there's more gene flow? I think that's possibly what you're getting at. And the answer is, we'd like to look at that. But to a first approximation, this will be spread out across the genome.
Yeah. I mean, this is genome-wide. But if you look in particular at the Kelch locus, you see a picture that is not that different from this.
Okay.
So you can suspect that this is the locus that is really driving the bears.
So if you remove Kelch, does this pattern go away?
No.
Right. Okay. So it's not sufficient to...
No, it's not.
Yeah. No. This isn't driven by Kelch. Sorry, I should have seen that we were getting at. No, this isn't at all driven by Kelch. So, to be honest, it's probably driven by things like where people live, where mountains are, how fast they travel, because the thing that's moving malaria around this region is human beings. Mosquitoes fly a couple of kilometers during their lifespan. So we're looking here at some feature of fundamentally human demography.
But you could do the same thing with humans, right? You just take human SNPs and build a tree of this sort?
Well, the answer is, that's a wonderful question. I've often thought about that. The answer is, I don't know. And it will depend on the demography of both. But I think at a global level, my sense is, comparing human data to Plasmodium data, I think that Plasmodium is more sedentary. You know, in other words, you know, if I'm a human and I go from Africa to Boston, my DNA, if I'm successful in Boston and become an investment banker, you know, my DNA gets propagated. But if I'm traveling from West Africa with malaria and I go to Boston, not much happens to that parasite. And I think that what we're seeing, interestingly, is Plasmodium is a relatively sedentary population, but it's being carried by humans around the place. So there is some mixing, and occasionally, and of course, the $64,000 question for drug resistance is what will it take for artemisinin resistance to make that leap? And that's really, all of my talk is gearing up to that big question. I don't know the answer, that's the big question. And is it just a question of a human migration, or is it some other biological fitness that has to be acquired to allow it between population compartments? And one other thing that can be maintaining population compartments apart from geography could, I'll just give you the range of possibilities. I told you at the outset there were 50 vector species. Now, it doesn't mean to say that any one parasite is equally viable in every vector species. So it may be that in making the move up here, a parasite has to adapt to a new vector species, which may require other variation. So to make leaps between population compartments, you have to have a carrier, but you have to be biologically fit in both. So anyway, I'll try to speed up again. So there's a really deep point that may or may not have come out of what I've said, which is just a beautiful deep point, which is that I mentioned already that we'd found sort of 20 or so variants. And in most cases, those variants are rather localized. They would be found only within one of these population compartments and possibly just within part of one of those population compartments. Now, that could be partly a sampling ascertainment bias thing, but I don't think that can fully account for it at all. So the question is, how far can one of these variants spread? You know, what we're seeing is all these variants coming up. What's stopping them spreading more? And what about those particular variants where we find them in multiple population compartments? There are a few variants, one in particular, 580Y variant, that's found in multiple population compartments. Now, when you look at the haplotypic structure around the 580Y, we find that clear evidence there are multiple independent origins of that mutation. So when we see this variant spreading between population compartments, it's not evidently driven by migration, it's driven by recurrent mutation. Did that make sense? So we have an extraordinary situation that the spread of artemisinin resistance appears to be due to the continual emergence of new KELCH 13 mutations. And if these KELCH 13 mutations cause artemisinin resistance, the question is what causes KELCH 13 mutations? Well, that's rather a bad way of putting it, because I've told you that our expectation is that in any, Roberto's worked it out, but I think Roberto's worked out that I'm right to say that an average person with malaria in 2 days would be expected to have 4 or 5 new resistance mutations in KELCH 13. So the driver is there, but what's causing them to enter the population? And actually, don't hold your breath too long because I don't know the answer, but it is the question. So I think what Roberto's going to talk to you about is then asking what's the difference between the KELCH 13 mutations we see in Africa, because we do see them there. We see probably just about as many as we see in Southeast Asia. What's the difference between those and those are the ones that we see in Asia? And the ones that Roberto's going to tell you is the ones we see in Africa are predominantly rare variants. They're not rising high frequency. And there's far fewer non-synonymous mutations. So what's causing non-synonymous mutations to rise up in the population of Southeast Asia? And what's stopping them spreading now across Southeast Asia? Now, to cut a very long story short, when we do a GWAS study, we find other loci that appear to be associated with delayed parasite clearance apart from this KELCH 13 locus. But when we account for the KELCH 13 locus, we find that basically the reason for these other associations is that they are strongly linked to the KELCH 13 mutations. And bottom line is they appear to be a genetic background on which KELCH 13 mutations are more likely to occur. There's many different lines of evidence for this. I'm going to just give you one example of a line of evidence. So what I'm showing you here on the left is a map of rates of artemisinin resistance in Southeast Asia. Here's this hot spot in Western Cambodia, and here you can see it's spreading out, it's moving out into to Vietnam, southern Thailand, into Myanmar, but it's not yet got up to Myanmar, and it hasn't yet got into the northern parts of Laos.
Okay.
Now, if I'd just shown you phenotypic data, that's to say clinical delayed parasite clearance, the map would look like this. Actually, I'm not sure, but the way I'm working out this map is I'm not showing that phenotype. What I'm just showing you is the number of parasites, the frequency of parasites, that bear a KELCH13 non-solanized mutation. And it turns out that's an almost perfect marker. Here I'm now showing you the allele frequencies of four of the other loci that came up on the GWAS. And you can see that they look very, very similar. Not identical, but very similar. So first approximation, they're not found in other parts of the world, and they correspond to this geographical distribution. So they seem to be marking the boundaries of a parasite population in which KELCH13 mutations are more likely to rise to high frequency. Now, what does that mean? It could mean that these are phenotypically important, that the KELCH13 mutation doesn't work without these. And we think that's not the case, because we can take these out of the equation and KELCH13 is still a very, very good predictor. It could be that they confer some biological fitness that allows KELCH13 mutations to survive. It may be nothing to do with the alpha-synuclein resistance phenotype, and that's a possibility. It could also be that they're just markers of a sort of, now I'm going to stumble here, I don't know what the right word is, but of a sort of ecosystem that is favorable for KELCH13 mutations to do whatever it has to do, to cause resistance and to be biologically fit. We think there's some sort of markers of biological fitness, but how they're managed, whether they're direct markers or just indirect markers of that, they may just be marking a population that's been badly abused over the years with lots of drugs being given in an irresponsible way or whatever, and they're just marking a group of parasites that have adapted in multiple different ways. But whichever way, they serve as the best. If you had to type a single mutation to determine whether a parasite is artemisinin resistant or not, you probably wouldn't type a KELCH mutation, you'd probably type one of these background mutations.
So in all these different countries, do they use the same types of combination therapies? Or is there a sort of barrier that you have to go over because there's a new drug that's using a combination with artemisinin and maybe with a sort of longer half-life or something? And it changes between countries, so it's more difficult for the parasites to be made.
Yeah, it's a great question. Because these countries are so politically distinct, it's very difficult to account for any of this by anything that's been done uniformly across the region. They've had very different political administrations, different policies, etc. It's true across all of the world that, you know, frontline drugs go in waves. You know, there's a wave of chloroquine usage, and then a wave of fancidar usage, and now a wave of ACT usage. But then the same is true in Africa as well. So there definitely will be things that are common across these. But, you know, you'd certainly be hard put to say that the boundary of this is marked by any particular drug treatment choice, for example.
So in this frequency distribution is strikingly similar.
Yeah.
So are they genetically linked or are they?
Well, I think we're struggling to find the right
one genome or one background, or is it are they independent to some extent?
They tend to co-occur all together.
Okay.
As I tell you, it's not perfect linkage, but yeah, overall they are all together.
I mean, a hypothesis that would, you know, potentially account for it is that these are indeed sort of epistatic effects. The epistasis may be acting on the artemisinin on drug resistance phenotype, but the epistasis might also be doing something else to do with biological fitness. I mean, if I just expand on that last point, an artemisinin resistant parasite is obviously better than a sensitive parasite if that patient is on artemisinin. But if it then goes into another patient who's not on artemisinin, and they probably won't be if it's the early phase of infection, so for several weeks they won't be symptomatic, that parasite may lose out against its peers because it's carrying a fitness cost. It may also not be fit inside a mosquito. So a drug resistance mutation is having to build around it a set of other genes that potentially compensate for that loss of fitness. So it may be that these do represent some sort of epistatic combination that's favorable. That's one hypothesis. That's the one we'd like to be true because it would be the easiest one to understand, but I think there are other ways of other alternative hypotheses.
But if they're very linked, then it's not necessary that they're
essential. Oh, yeah. Beg your pardon. I shouldn't have used the word epistasis. I should have just simply said that it's good when they're all around. Yeah.
Well, and there are different chromosomes.
Yeah. There are different chromosomes, yeah.
So,
well, I mean,
they're not linked in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on, there's a hard and a loose definition of, I mean, let's put it more specifically. The combination is better than not having the combination. Let's leave it at that, yeah. Anyway, this is what we find, and so we are interested in how this has evolved, and by the way, it's clear that these mutations antedated the Artemisinin-Gelfand mutation. So we've clearly got, put very simply, we seem to, if you put in cancer terminology, I guess we've got markers of the risk of a new cancer emerging, effectively here, and we'd like to understand how we can use that information. Now, I'm just going to pass on this.
Dominic,
I should wrap
if you up. If you can wrap up in about 5 to 10 minutes, that's perfect, and we can continue coffee.
Yeah. Well, I think that Ian, are you going to talk about mixed infections?
It's not in my talk tomorrow. If there's interest, maybe I will later in the week.
Well, just for the modelling, you know, if we try to put this together in some sort of population genetic or population dynamic model, you know, I just listed here some of the obvious factors that are going to influence the spread of resistance. I haven't, you know, in my previous slides, I've touched on the issue of biological fitness, which I think is a deep thing which we have to understand. But clearly, at a very high level, we have to understand something about human demography, mosquito ecology, and then the parasite, how it's migrating and recombining. And I just want to elucidate a bit more on this issue of mixed infection. So people who carry mixed infections of different parasite genotypes are the drivers of genetic reassortment in Parasitarium populations, because when a mosquito samples from that mixed infection, that recombination has the potential to occur. So for a long time, malariologists have been trying to get some sort of metric of that mixedness, and typically they'll type genotypes at a number of different loci and work out how many different genotypes they can see. And so multiplicity of infections have, in general, in most of the literature, range from 1 to 5. That's been a sort of typical thing. And that sort of, we had to sort of do a double take when we sort of realized that actually we're talking about a genome with a million variants, massive recombination, massive potential for mixed infection. MRIs like 3 didn't really mean very much, because actually it's a scalar metric that's describing quite a complex thing. What you're really asking is, of those billion parasites, what are their ancestral relationships? And you can imagine a situation where you actually have possibly 4 major ancestor-related groups, all of which are sort of slightly varying, and then maybe 10 other minor groups in there that came from infections years ago that have nothing to do with them. So we need a much more complex way of describing it. But when we first started sequencing, and the level of heterogeneity is determined by things like the number of times an individual is infected by different mosquitoes, the genetic diversity of the local population, the diversity of parasites inoculated by a single mosquito bite, and then obviously there's a dynamical aspect. You can have a population that's highly diverse in an individual, but it is effectively clonal because one parasite is out competing the rest. So with deep sequencing data, we can start to estimate what's going on, and many groups have sort of said, can we work out MII just by sort of looking at how many haplotypes, for example, we can count in a given locus? That would be one aspect. But with short read sequencing data, we found that a struggle. It will be possible at some point maybe to make discrete measures of that sort, but we found that difficult. But we found this is something we published in Nature a couple of years ago. I put it up because this reminds me of my my sort of second and third form physics experiments where you had to plot points and you got straight lines. I think it's the first time in biology I've actually found straight lines. What we did here is we asked across the genome for, I'll start again. We go across the genome, and for each locus, we ask, how heterozygous is that in the local parasite population? Get a measure. And then we bin the different variant positions in the genome according to their heterozygosity in the local population. So here's a bunch of variants that are highly diverse in the local population, a bunch of variants that are not diverse at all. And now we take an individual sample, and each of these lines represents data from an individual sample. And we plot those same SNPs, and we ask, how much heterozygosity do we see in that individual? That makes sense. And it turns out that we get a different answer for every individual, but in each case we get a straight line. Isn't that nice? I was expecting people to be more impressed. Straight lines are rare in my world. And
so those are a bunch of individuals in one place, worldwide.
This is a worldwide selection, but in each case where you have to gate it locally because you're comparing in each case, your denominator is how much heterozygosity you see in this person compared to the person in the population. Let me put it in lay language. If you have a mixed infection, and I ask at any position in the genome, what's the probability I'll find parasites are different? It's going to be proportional to how different they were in the general population. Yeah. Fundamentally. Now it turns out
How do you define a local population?
Oh well, in this case we've just meant like, you know, Kenya is Kenya.
The same country. Yeah.
It wasn't too precise.
Well, what it says is
Alfred samples, you know, Francois samples, you know.
The boundary in variation defined by a human is invisible to the population.
Yes. Could you repeat that just to...
Yeah. You might naively think that the boundary that's defined by an individual somehow is that boundary is rather permeable with respect from the perspective of the plasmodia.
Yes, sure, that's true. Yeah. Yes, sorry, I might have confused you by talking about local populations. I use that word loosely. I'm just simply saying you use your denominator, what you see. I just say the population, but you are sensible, you don't mix up parasites.
From different locations.
So the cool thing is that if we now look at the ratio of the heterozygosity we see in the individual to the heterozygosity we see in the population, that turns out to be something that looks very much like Wright's inbreeding coefficient. It's this thing here. So we can actually, the slope of that line, when you subtract it from 1, gives you this value here, or a surrogate measure of that. Now, we're not explicitly measuring. To do that exactly, we'd have to measure what was going on in the progeny of a cross. But we're getting a surrogate measure of that. We're saying that we're seeing when a parasite samples an individual, the pool of parasites they're sampling, the slope of that line is very closely related to the inbreeding coefficient. Did that make sense? I can see, it's obviously not making sense to everyone, but I'm happy to, and that turns out to vary widely between populations. So this inbreeding coefficient is very, very high in Papua New Guinea, and that's interesting because rates of malaria transmission are quite high there, and I think this comes back to your question earlier, we think the reason for that is because in Papua New Guinea, people live in very isolated villages, and so that's maintaining a very high rate of inbreeding. Whereas in West Africa, we get much lower inbreeding coefficients. So I'll just leave it at that. So I only gave that last example to say that there are aspects that we can do, bulk measures we can do on genomic data, that start to get us to rather basic metrics that are rather useful. So I was complaining earlier that MRI was a sort of scalar metric, a very complex thing. This is also a scalar metric, and it doesn't capture all the richness of it, but it's actually a tractable metric, one that you can actually use to work things out. And you can quantify very precisely. So I'll leave it at that point. So.
Thank you.
So I propose we have a COVID break now and continue discussion over the COVID break, and we continue for the past and Philip is going to talk.
Oh, sorry, can I just put up the...
Yeah, of course.